Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I'm your co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share the natural women's health and motherhood guidance that you've been looking for through our fresh, functional, and balanced lens. Today's topic on prenatal ultrasounds is a controversial one. It seems that people tend to live in one of two camps. They either get them as normal and don't really question it, or they refuse all of them and think that they're damaging. So let's break it down. We talk about the risks, the actual evidence that we have to date, the imperfections with the technology, with false positives and false negatives. And then what about the benefits to mom and baby, whether those be in minor or major ways? There's a lot of nuance here. So let's start learning. Hi. Okay. Today, Dr. Leah and I are back and we are in our new podcast setup. So
you
have a whole new look to yours and setup, which is gorgeous.
Thanks. Yours has always been gorgeous.
Oh my God. Thank you.
You're the OG gorgeous background.
Well, yours is a perfect color for you because you're a muted summer.
Yes,
and
I am.
Me as a bright spring. This is a good one for me too. So anyway, we are really excited to share with you guys that we're making big podcast improvements. We've hired Podigy, which is a company that is helping us do all new editing, especially on our YouTube page. And so if you're watching this on YouTube, obviously you're going to be seeing the difference here. And if you're just listening on any of the other podcast apps, you can head over to YouTube and watch us and see some of the fun things, but you'll still notice the way that it's edited with like the trailer in the front and different things that we are trying really hard to up-level the podcast. So
yay!
We would also, I'm just shamelessly going to ask for your support in sharing with friends and, you know, send it to people. And if you don't already actually like subscribe, which is now called follow, but if you are on YouTube, please subscribe. You should, and it would be great if you did. So please just take a second and do that. Rate and review us. Yeah, rate and review us because we're trying super hard and we do this for you and we love it. And also it needs to be sustainable because we both have like little kids and it's hard to do this, but we really want to keep going. And so we're doing the best we can. But so today we are going to talk all about ultrasounds, which is a very polarizing topic within the natural motherhood world. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of balance, I feel like, that we can bring to it. And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can, but I think that we should talk about the risks and the benefits and all of the different things that I think that people are curious about. Like what I get asked almost on a daily basis, what's your thought on ultrasound? And so here are all my thoughts on ultrasound.
I feel like we're really good at having that balanced viewpoint. And I just don't know why that's not more common.
I don't know either. I think that people like to fit into a camp. They want to fit into, if I'm a natural health mom, if I'm a crunchy person, I reject every medical option given to me. And it just, It doesn't have to be like that. You can say there's problems with the medical system for sure, but there's also a lot of benefits with the medical system. And we don't need to live like it's 1750 where people died all the time. Like we don't have to do that. We can pick and choose to our comfort level. I mean, if you want to do that, I guess go for it. But you're definitely going to be assuming the risk in somewhat unnecessary ways. And that's kind of like where I land when it comes to ultrasound is I feel like there are benefits that can be reaped, but they also need to be done cautiously.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't have to be all or nothing because there are going to be the people who never even think about it. They go and they get an early ultrasound at 6 weeks. Then they're told to get one again at 12 weeks and they get one maybe maybe they do the anatomy scan or one even beforehand. And then maybe something kind of weird shows up on the anatomy scan. So then they're like, let's do another one at 32 weeks. And then, oh, okay, maybe your baby's a little bit big. Let's do another one to monitor size at 36 weeks. You know, there's going to be people who are in a track where they're not really consciously thinking about the risks at all. And they're just kind of going along with that. But then there's going to be the people that are like, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's just for the person who's not struggling to conceive. If you get into the fertility world, especially if you're doing fertility treatments or IVF, I mean, there are people who, because they're so anxious, want to go and get an ultrasound every week.
Yes.
Of their early pregnancy. And even in IVF, you get at least two before you move from your IVF doctor to your OB-GYN. Then they'll do another one. So most people on that track have at least three or four before they even get out of their first trimester. And some people have even more. So, you know, that's just like for a normal woman who wasn't even going through fertility treatments. And I'm not saying like, don't ever do an ultrasound because absolutely, like I had to do one, but I know when I did IVF, they offered me two, you know, one at 5 or 6 weeks and then another one a week later. I'm just like, why do I need another one? We just saw that the baby had a heartbeat. Everything's good. And so these are other things for people to think about, that they aren't necessarily harmless. They are definitely helpful, but not always harmless. So we just need to hold it all in our hearts and our heads.
Yeah. And we have to think about these fertility clinics and what are other kind of clinic, maybe it's just your regular OBGYN, as businesses. And so they make a lot of money. We talked about this on the Life Update podcast, that one of your IVF ultrasounds to check your follicles and things was like $600. And so for them to get another $600 out of you to check your baby 1 week later, like, we have to understand why they would maybe do that. And in a routine basis, where it actually is probably going to do no good to see what's happening between 1 week and the next, unless there hadn't been a heartbeat detected and then they were wanting to go forward with that. But even then, you could still trust and just go forward with it. Okay, all right. So we're going to talk about all of this. So the questions that I want to answer in today's podcast, or we're going to try to answer the most pressing questions about ultrasound, which would be like, have babies been saved by ultrasound? I'm going to say yes. Have babies been harmed by ultrasound? I'm going to say yes. Mm-hmm. What's the actual evidence around any of these potential physiologically damaging effects that we hear? You know, people say like neurodevelopmental disorders, oh, ultrasounds are the cause of autism, ultrasounds cause miscarriage, ultrasounds cause all these different things. And let's look at the actual statistics, but then also we're going to look at the actual statistics of some of these anomalies that can occur in the maternal world that, like, maybe if we found them on ultrasound, it could change the trajectory of our baby's health. But, and that's like kind of where I come from and being like, I think that these can be a good idea to an extent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's just dive into the one that I think everybody wants to go with first, which is, what are the risks? What are the possible issues with getting an ultrasound? And then we'll talk about benefits, and then we'll talk about sort of where I think we can land as a healthy balance. So one of the issues with ultrasound technology is something called cavitation. So cavitation is where we use an ultrasound technology and it can actually cause these like very small little bubbles to be produced in whatever the kind of tissue it is. And it can occur in like seconds, it can occur in minutes, but we have to know that there are two main distinct different types of ultrasound technology. There is diagnostic ultrasound, which is the type that's going to be used on your baby when you're looking at a fetus, or even if even all of the other ultrasound technologies of looking at your uterus, your follicles, your ovaries, any of that is going to be a diagnostic ultrasound. It's a much lower intensity. Then we have something called like our therapeutic ultrasound. That's for like ablation and physiotherapy. We do ultrasound technology in that sort of a way to help with like muscle and, you know, joint issues, things like that. And that's a much higher intensity type of ultrasound that does cause a bigger cavitation, because that's sort of the purpose of what it's trying to do. But in our diagnostic ultrasound, at the low intensity that we use, the chance of cavitation is very, very, very low. So we just have to sort of rest assured that that's the case. But then in some of our rodent studies is really all we have, there has been some things noted, but of course they're using ultrasound in like really long periods of time, like from 5 minutes to up to 7 hours, and then they're seeing what happens. And so in those studies, I mean, just worthy of noting, because maybe the people who are very anti-ultrasound are seeing these studies and information getting really freaked out, and I can understand why. But so what we're seeing in those rodent studies is like altered neuron migration. So the neurons in the brain are moving around kind of inappropriately during these critical windows of development. And we're also seeing in those rodents then later impaired learning and memory performance. And so it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? We're also seeing increased cell death. But again, that kind of makes sense given what they were doing to those baby mice and rats and whatever they are. And it's just, it's not that way in most ultrasound settings. Now, I always do say to people, get the quickest ultrasound you can. Don't have them just be hanging out. Like if it's a heartbeat ultrasound, as soon as you see that heartbeat, just say, okay, thank you, I don't need it anymore. Like there's no point. Now the anatomy scan, that's the one that usually people get around week 20 in the midway point of the pregnancy, is gonna be longer because they're measuring different things. They're looking at every part of baby's body. But if we're doing any kind of other ultrasound that doesn't have a specific anatomical purpose like that, it should be it should be on the quicker end. Wait, you were going to say something just a second ago.
You know, I was just agreeing with you. And what do you feel like there is a difference in what you're seeing with early ultrasounds versus those mid-point ultrasounds, you know, being really careful about being quick, you know, in the 6 to 12 week ones versus the 20, because most things are developed at that point?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Let me try to find my note here, because yes, there is increased risk with multiple or prolonged scans, specifically in the first trimester. Yeah. So there's some very few studies that are showing like a tiny bit of, when we look in a retrospective way, meaning we're basically just polling women who have children that have like specifically the neurodevelopmental issues, ADD, ADHD, autism, etc. And then we're polling them and asking them what about their ultrasound history in the past. And in those cases where they had many or prolonged in the first trimester, there is a slight risk, but they don't account for in those cases any of the confounding risk factors, which I think is appropriate, because it's like, well, why was the woman having multiple and prolonged scans in the first trimester? Was there something kind of going on that was odd anyway? And that in and of itself could have been the main risk factor and cause of the then neurodevelopmental disorder later on, you know. But like, some people don't think about that. They don't see that full picture of the way that we have to do studies to account for it. Or, you know, what was all of the different set and setting of what was going on with that particular issue. So I think that cavitation is something that probably can happen, yes, if we are being, especially because we have different modern technology now. Our ultrasound technology is a lot more intense than it used to be, and we have a lot more levels, like, you know, we can do the 3D and the 4D and different things for our imaging. And also there's a variety between tech to tech. So your technician may be quick and efficient and great at it, or your technician may be like the first time they've ever done this, and so they're going a lot slower. They don't know what they're doing. Maybe they have it on a different setting. You know, there's always those kinds of things. But again, I still think that these risks overall are low, but I did want to just call it out. The other thing that can happen that causes concern is the thermal effects of ultrasound. So It can raise a fetal tissue between 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, a lot, and kind of alarming. And it depends on the duration and the settings that the ultrasound technology is set to. But I think that overall, again, it's not happening to humans on a level that is so, so, so concerning. But I do think it behooves us. It's important to try to be quick with something like that when there is a potential that if we're slow, maybe these things do happen. So, you know, then there's going to be the women who have twins, they have a subchorionic hemorrhage, they have something weird going on where they have to get repeat ultrasounds. And now you're listening to this and you're like, great, well, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, listen, if that's what's happening to you though, and they're monitoring your something very important with your baby, to me, probably most likely the benefits of the monitoring outweigh any of these theoretical risks, because whatever is going on with your child needs to be seen, maybe because that's going to change your treatment plan, your birth plan, the way the baby is treated directly after their birth, like whatever. We need to know some of that stuff. So what I'm not a fan of is when people buy a Doppler and they are checking their baby's heartbeat every day because of their anxiety, or they go to these little hole in the wall, like keepsake ultrasound places all the time to get photos and to just check in on their baby because they want to see it. I think that that kind of thing is purposeless. I mean, other than you getting what you selfishly want, but I think it's that with it is like, now we're teetering into risk with no benefit. And why? Like, even actually here, let me read this because I just want to get it right. Yeah, the ACOG and the WHO, so the World Health Organization, which in some ways ACOG is terrible, and in other ways I'm like, oh, I'm surprised to hear that you say that, you know, because they miss the mark in a lot of ways. Same thing with the WHO, but they both recommend limiting ultrasounds to only those that are medically indicated and as short as possible to obtain just the diagnostic information that you're looking for and then be done. So I think that that's important. Like, we need to be really...
Yeah, that is. That's crazy.
Yeah, we need to be listening to that. And it also just makes logical sense when we look into it. So some other negative sides of ultrasound, though, would be increased anxiety if there's false positives, and how that can ruin sort of like a maternal fetal bond happening during your pregnancy. And unfortunately, this is one of the problems. This is like an overarching problem, not just the disruption of the fetal bond and increase in anxiety, but actual impacts made to the baby when there's a false positive of something that maybe then the mother goes and gets like an abortion. And it's a false positive. There was actually nothing wrong with the baby.
That's crazy.
I know three women specifically, actually now I'm thinking of a fourth case, where they were told in their first trimester ultrasounds between the NIPT, which is the non-invasive prenatal testing test, between the NIPT and their 12-week ultrasound that their baby had, three of them were told their baby had trisomy 21, so Down syndrome. One of them was told that their baby had such severe, significant malformation. It didn't really have a chromosomal aspect to it, but it was just like incompatible with life. And oh, nope, sorry. Now I'm thinking of a fifth one too. And all five of these women went forward with their pregnancies, but they were offered abortion. The three that were given the trisomy 21 diagnosis were already this was a subsequent baby. They were already moving forward. They were going to have the baby regardless. The two that were told about the malformation were very like, it was horrific and terrible and horrible. And they were butted up against, you know, philosophical and theoretical questions that they never knew that they were going to experience. And it was awful because they were just trying to decide at any moment, like, this baby could die inside of me and then I'm delivering them, or what's happening. But then by the 20-week anatomy scan, those issues were non-detectable.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, how would they even know so early on like that? I feel like it's got to be so dependent on the tech and what they're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, they think in one of those cases that the baby was very delayed in some of the anatomical changes. Like, it was just so slow. Like, it didn't look like it was developing properly. And then it kind of caught up and everything was fine. The baby ended up being born beautifully and perfectly normal. One of the cases, there is going to be still some complication with the baby, but it's not at all as severe as what they had been laying out. And they think that the baby could go on to have a normal life. And then those three trisomy 21 cases, none of those babies had trisomy 21.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Two of these women we went to school with. And it's like, this is crazy because you are telling someone something that's going to affect the entire rest of their experience in pregnancy with worry and planning and trying to decide what to do and how's this going to change their life. And, you know, so that is a risk for sure. False positives happen. False negatives also happen. So a false positive is where the technology of whatever form it is says you have this thing when you actually don't have the thing. There's different rates of risk for that. And I'm going to talk about specific diseases or anomalies and their false positive rate. Then there's false negatives, which is where the technology says, nope, everything's great and fine, but actually there's something going on. Those are also an issue with ultrasound technology. So ultrasounds are not perfect. Like, no one is saying they're perfect. No one is saying that they are like the absolute magical thing, but it can be a tool that we can dip into and use. It's kind of like cervical checks. I don't think that cervical checks are purposeless. I think that they are overused. It's kind of the same thing, actually. They are overused, just like ultrasound, and they do have harm, just like ultrasound, but used as one piece of information in a constellation of information, if we're really looking at it and deep diving and investigating, taking the patient or the person before us and the situation in front of us and like thinking critically, and, you know, all of that, I think it can be a helpful tool in more cases than not. Like, I think it's overall more beneficial than not. So, yeah, and I will go back to some of the false positive and false negative rates. But because of those false positive and false negative rates, the next sort of like risk or downside of ultrasound is this idea of increased medicalization of the woman and the baby with maybe these unnecessary interventions because of these unnecessary findings or untrue findings. So maybe she's told to go on to get an amniocentesis for your diagnostic, your fully true diagnostic chromosomal, ruling it in or ruling it out, which is taking a big long needle and inserting it into over her abdomen, into the uterus, and taking out a little bit of amniotic fluid, because now you can really get fetal cells to a higher degree of accuracy to see, does this baby actually have a chromosomal issue or whatever it is that we're looking at? Or maybe it's they're suggesting, you know, induction early because maybe you're past 20 weeks and, or, you know, some kind of like late term abortion, or maybe they're suggesting like something with IUGR, so intrauterine growth restriction. If the baby is measuring very small, there's actually a very high false positive on IUGR, like 30 to 50%.
Yeah, it's a big reason why women are told to get induced, right? Is because they're like, your baby's too big.
Well, that's too big, but yeah, this one's too small. But yes, for sizes of babies, sizes of babies on ultrasound is really inaccurate. The difference with IUGR is that they take like, they take other measurements of the abdomen and the cranium and stuff. So then they're not just looking at what they think the weight is. They're looking at the actual size and the growth on the growth chart, which is important for an IUGR baby to be born if they're really, truly having a growth restriction, because your stillbirth rate of an IUGR baby goes up by 5 to 10 times higher than a normal stillbirth rate. So I understand. And here's the thing, you guys, too. Most of the time, medical professionals in the obstetric world are not trying to harm people. The problem is this like ego, this God complex that comes in, and we think that we can mess with stuff and that it's not going to ever cause any problem. And we like to dismiss women. We like to do all that kind of stuff. But they're not setting out, like their alarm goes off in the morning and they're saying to themselves, can't wait to hurt as many babies as I possibly can today. That's not what's happening. Okay. And it's hard and they're overworked. Everything about that entire structure has to change. It is 12-hour shifts in a hospital like that. I don't think it's working very well. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a labor and delivery nurse. I'm not an OBGYN. I'm not a midwife. But I just have to think that, like, there's a little bit of dehumanization that happens when you're just from room to room to room and you're managing the medications and then they're complaining about stuff and then their birth plan and then this one's on this and this one's doing that. And then now you're just kind of like, you know what? Like, let's just do it. Like, let's just, no, this labor's not, blah, 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 blah. It's hard for them to maintain this humanity of how important this experience is for everybody. And same thing with this prenatal obstetric, using the ultrasounds, using the NIPT, trying to figure out what's happening, trying to make a plan for the baby. And they're usually trying, they're betting their edge to do the best thing that they can for you and your baby. But there is risks and issues. And that's why I think it is important for women to know, because we can say, well, there's such a high false positive rate with this baby. Like, what about, okay, because here's what might happen is they might just take an abdominal measurement with the tape. You know, they put it right on your pubic bone and then they go up to where the top of the fundus of the uterus is. If they're doing that and they're saying, oh, see, your baby's really small. Like, no, that's not an IUGR diagnosis. Like those kinds of things, like, come on, no. But now you, as the listener, are informed and empowered to know that there should be a deeper investigation there if that's what they're going to say. They cannot make these flippant statements that are going to change everything about the rest of your pregnancy and birth on something silly like that, or a preeclampsia diagnosis based on one high blood pressure reading. No, 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 no. Like, stop. It's not happening. Okay, so this is where we do need to be on it, because sometimes they do just do silly things. But I just want to say that, like, I know we talk a lot about kind of the problems in the conventional world. There's problems in the natural world too, you guys. And I'm not trying to bash them. I'm just trying to say, yo, here's some of the issues. And when you have information and knowledge, you can be empowered in various ways. So electrolytes are trending, yes, but they have been in need of our human bodies for all of time. And if you're drinking another popular and delicious salty electrolyte, here's why you should be drinking Relight instead. First of all, have you ever considered the salt source of these other brands? Because most of them just use table salt. Yeah, table salt. You don't want that. Redmond's Relight Powders uses their unrefined ancient sea salt that they mine in Utah. This salt source contains 60 plus trace minerals along with calcium, chloride, potassium, and magnesium in two different forms, glycinate and malate. The minerals that they use in the Relight Powders are all in the appropriate proportions and forms too. The metabolic needs of pregnancy, healing postpartum, and milk making require more minerals than in other times of your life. Pregnancy itself demands huge increases in your blood volume, which takes, you know, more minerals. Relight is the perfect blend to be sipping during your pregnancy or during your labor even, and especially while you're breastfeeding. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavors oscillate between mixed berry, lemon lime, and the strawberry lemonade. But you can try a sample pack and try all the flavors for yourself and see what you think. Use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% on your entire Redmond order. That includes their OG sea salt, other seasonings, bentonite clays, toothpaste, and more.
You say it, Dr. Morgan.
Yeah, passionate about this topic.
I love it.
Okay.
Who knew you could be so passionate about ultrasounds?
I know. Well, I get upset when people are like, there's no purpose in an ultrasound.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of want to go in a boxing rink with those people. Not that I want to hurt them physically. I mean, an argumentative boxing ring.
Yeah, like, figuratively.
Yeah, figuratively. I want to be like, wait, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? But I think it's also a mindset shift. It's a philosophical change. It's like the free birth mentality where you're like, I'm willing to assume the risk of whatever might happen. And they are more comfortable assuming that kind of risk than assuming the risk of these, like the cavitation, the increased thermal thing. So we have to understand that everybody has their own benefit risk ratio of where they're comfortable, what they're going to prioritize one over the another thing. I think, though, that there is some facts that we can go by, which is like overall, in my opinion, more benefit than harm. But okay, so the next one that I hear a lot is like, okay, ultrasounds cause an increased risk of miscarriage. And there is no link to that, like none at all. What I think is happening here is that a baby's heartbeat in the first trimester can stop at any time, or their growth restriction can stop them from growing at any time. But what could happen is that a woman goes and sees a heartbeat, and then she thinks, okay, everything's great. And yes, your statistics, when you do see a heartbeat on an ultrasound, your statistics of having a miscarriage after that drop like dramatically, because just they do. Okay. But the baby's heartbeat could stop the next day just by happenstance. And it doesn't have to do with the fact that you had an ultrasound. It could, I guess. We don't know. We do need to do way more studies. I mean, one thing I will say for sure is that we need way more newer, updated studies, because a lot of our studies on ultrasound technology are old, old, old. And they sort of kept it that way, again, because of economics, I think, and business. But we just have to understand that, too, that just because we see it doesn't mean for sure that it's guaranteed. Nothing's guaranteed. So sometimes people will have that experience where they get an ultrasound and, like, you know, the next day or the next week, the baby passes, and then it's easy to say like, well, what, you know, maybe it was that. And I mean, I guess we have to always keep that in our head that there could have been something, who knows? And maybe it was just enough. Maybe the baby was already very, very vulnerable, and it was just enough of some sort of something that caused the baby to pass, you know? Okay, now this neurodevelopmental risk that is kind of a big scary one that people don't want to deal with. Let's talk about some of the studies that we do have. So in short, in humans, the like routine medically indicated ultrasound tests that we get that are not like just for fun and all these different things have not been shown to increase the risk of any neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. Okay. And even with our like best data sets of these like randomized controlled trial, well-controlled cohorts, I mean, we can't do it completely, but the best that we can have overall very good results. So there was a randomized controlled trial called the RAIN study, where families were randomized into either a 1 scan or a 5 scan group throughout the pregnancy. And then between ages 1 and 8, those children were evaluated. There was no differences in speech, language, behavior, or neurologic development. The same trial later specifically checked autism outcomes and again found no difference. I don't know how many families were in this group. I should look at that, but I'm just kind of going over some of the generals. The CDC did a big one, which I know we all have our problems with these big three-letter things. They're not perfect, but they looked at 1,500 singleton pregnancies, meaning like just one baby, not twins, and looked at the autism spectrum disorder assessment and found no association between the number of prenatal ultrasounds and the first trimester specifically. So that's good, because that's kind of the one that's scariest. Then we did some kind of like intensity and dose studies to look at, you know, how does that work? And it didn't translate to an increased risk in autism either. So there's a lot of different things that can be ruled out, sort of. I know they're not perfect. We do need to do more, but it really does not seem like something that that families need to be super freaked out over, truly.
Yeah, I think it's so hard too, because there are so many things that happen in pregnancy, and it's so easy to be like, oh, well, that thing is happening, therefore, it must be leading to this. Like, the rates of autism are increasing. Everyone's getting ultrasounds. It must be that. You know, these are all correlations. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't contribute to some degree, because there's so much that we see on our end of things that contribute to stuff. But it's like you just have to understand all of the different contexts. And just because something might be happening around a time doesn't necessarily mean it's causing it. Mm-hmm. There's definitely something contributing to like the rates of autism. But you know, personally, I think it's a lot of other things that people aren't even looking at, like mold. And, you know, they're so afraid of ultrasound and they're not even like looking at all these other things. But I think that it's important to know these things, because most people don't know. They don't know what studies are saying. They don't really know a lot of things in general. They just hear someone say something and they're very scared. And like you're saying, it's important to know the risks and the benefits, but understanding where you can push and where you should like pull back. But these studies are on people who are just doing routine, right? Not like a bunch of ultrasounds like you mentioned.
Yes. And so that's important, because we don't know what happens when the people are doing you know, 7-8 ultrasounds, and they have a home Doppler, and they're checking which a Doppler intensity is more. It's the same technology as ultrasound.
Yeah. Can you speak about that? Can you speak about the Doppler? Because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding that people are like, oh, I'm not going to do an ultrasound, I'm just going to do a Doppler. And there's this sort of idea that it's so safe.
Yeah, Doppler technology is actually using ultrasound waves still. It just doesn't produce the image. So we're still using that to pick up on the heartbeat. And when people buy, or gosh, I saw a reel the other day of this couple that was like an influencer couple, and they had bought one of the, like, which midwives will use at home, one of the, like, connect to your phone ultrasound wands so that they could just check on their baby at any time. And I'm like, okay, this is not what we need to be doing. Like, that to me needs no shame to them. They probably don't know this, but I'm just saying that I would not ever suggest. I would not suggest getting a Doppler. And here's the thing. Okay. There's two main benefits of an early, like a first trimester ultrasound. One is for dating and two is for anxiety. So let's just talk about the anxiety piece first, because I think that that's why a lot of people will buy these in-home Dopplers. I have had with my first three babies a first trimester ultrasound to confirm heartbeat because I was freaking out and tried to lean into, actually, no, with my son, with my first, I did not try to lean into anything. I was like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. I need to confirm a heartbeat. Like, that's just the way my mindset was. And then with my second, because I'd had a miscarriage. Okay, that's the other thing. When you've had loss, it changes everything about your subsequent pregnancies because you're very worried that it's going to happen again. And you kind of assume it's going to. And until it's like guilty until proven innocent, you know, it's like reverse of what it should be. And that is one of the benefits, I think, of the free birth mindset is like a deep, deep, deep trust and surrender and acceptance that like we have no control. And we as modern humans and women want to control everything, and our egos come into it, and we want to like sway the baby's gender, and we want to sway this, that, and the other thing, and we want to like know all of it. And I think that's one of the beautiful mysteries of pregnancy is pregnancy, birth, and parenting in general, is that like this is a dance and an interplay between two people now. It's not just you. Yes, you are the one that is pregnant, but there is 50% of this equation is this baby who you don't know yet, but it has inhabited your body. Their spirit is in your ethereal space. You are being impacted by them already. And we want to think that we have ultimate control. We want to think we have ultimate control in the way that our birth is going to go, our breastfeeding journey, the way that we're going to parent, the way our kids are going to end up, because we're going to parent them perfectly. And they're just going to sleep and they're going to be quiet and they're going to be good and they're not going to do anything bad. It's just like, it's such a humbling experience because we have no idea until we know. Like, I think it's a big growing up experience for women and families, parents in general, to have kids and be like, oh, okay. Like, wow. And so leaning into the big mystery of what is going on in your body, like it's hard and it does produce a lot of anxiety. And if we can get to that point where we can quell our anxiety with deep surrender and acceptance of whatever is, because there is almost nothing you can do in the first trimester, save from making sure your progesterone levels are adequate.
I know. That is true.
That is one. Okay, so we don't need to lose unnecessary babies because we have low progesterone. That is a big one. We'll put that in the show notes. Can you write that down, please? That if you don't know what we're talking about, low progesterone is a common cause of first trimester, not common, I guess, but it's one of the pieces of first trimester miscarriage that is sad and tragic to us because it's preventable. And nothing is maybe otherwise wrong with the baby, but mom just simply does not have enough progesterone to maintain. And so the body goes, oh, there's nothing actually happening here. And then it has a period. That's basically what happens. So we want our bodies to really know robustly that there is a healthy baby growing inside of us and keep it in. So progesterone, gestation, progestation. We need progesterone in pregnancy. Now, save from that, though, there's not that much that we can even do in the first trimester to prevent a baby from going if they're going to go. A lot of the time, too, it's like a blighted ovum. That means like that's what's, you know, a first trimester miscarriage could be the cause of. And that's like where the baby didn't even develop in the first place. Like the sac developed and it was trying, but there is no embryo inside of it. There was no way it could ever possibly become a human. There's just so many different things that can happen. Every single pregnancy is a miracle, truly. And up to 25% of pregnancies in general will end in loss. And so we need to know that the odds are in our favor. They're 75%, yes, a go, only 25% low. But checking incessantly with a Doppler or being very, very anxious all the time because you're just so worried, is neither of these are good. So we need to figure out a different way to cope. So if you can cope and you can get yourself to that point of radical acceptance and just be like, you know what, I'm not bleeding. Okay. My belly is growing. Although through the first trimester, it doesn't really seem to change that much, at least with your first pregnancy. But like, if time were to just go on, like everything, I'm going to just believe right now that everything is going fine. And today I am pregnant. And this is like mantras I have to tell myself. Like, it's very nerve-wracking, but I have to tell myself, you know what? Today I'm pregnant and I love this baby for as long as I get to be with them, as long as I get to carry them. And that could be 4 more days, or that could be all the way to the end and for the rest of my life. Like, we do not know. And so if you can get there, cool. And if you can't, and if you're riddled with anxiety, I think getting a first trimester ultrasound and checking out and seeing a heartbeat, if that's going to quell you so you're not having cortisol running through your system, which is going to affect your baby's development in a negative way, then do it. Like, do it. It's not every woman can get to that point where they're like, no, I don't even take a pregnancy test. I'm just going and having a wild pregnancy. It's like, that's great. And that is not the way for every woman. Like, it's just not. It would be cool. And that is how it used to be when we didn't have these technologies. We didn't have the luxury of knowing anything. We just had to go about our lives and say, well, I didn't bleed this month, so I guess I'm pregnant. You know, literally, like, that's how it used to be. I'm reading this book right now, Frozen River. It's really, really good. It's by Ariel Lahan. And it's from like the late 1700s. And she is a midwife. And it's great. But it is interesting hearing the way that things were back then, where they're just like, oh, how many months have you skipped your cycle now? That's how they tell how pregnant they are. They're like, oh, 3. Like, I have had no period for 3 months. It's like, okay, well,
you know, you're in your second trimester.
Yep. There we go. Okay. You're pregnant. And so anyway, I think that there can be a benefit there with it reducing anxiety so that the mom can feel connected, so that she can move forward beyond this like mental stuck place. And I have experienced that for sure. So I get that. I feel it with my second pregnancy. I really wanted to lean into just trusting, but because I'd had that prior miscarriage, I did a heartbeat ultrasound at like 11 weeks. So I kept pushing myself. It was really tricky because, you know, you don't really feel a lot of symptoms unless you're super nauseous. But unfortunately, you can maintain being very nauseous even when the baby has stopped growing. And even when you've had a miscarriage, and this is a very rude thing because people will think, well, I'm having symptoms, so I'm still pregnant, everything's going well. And it's like, nope, the baby could have passed and your body just hasn't registered it yet. And you're still having all of these symptoms that make you feel like you're very, very pregnant and you're not. Similarly, people will freak out because they are not having symptoms and they think, oh, something is terribly wrong. I'm not pregnant anymore. But you could just be having an easy time. And so it's tricky. I don't have the right answer. I can just see a benefit, though, in reducing anxiety in that sort of specific way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of similar to what people ask me what they should do about ultrasound, because in the fertility space, it's so nerve-wracking. You don't want to do anything that's going to affect anything. But like you said, you had a previous loss. People who are going through infertility or having loss, yeah, the stress and anxiety that would be there to wait even until 12 weeks, I think, is so extreme. And so I do tell people, like what I did, I think it's okay to get an early ultrasound, but just the one, you know, and to confirm, yes, the transfer worked. If it's IVF, yes, you're pregnant, there's a heartbeat. And I think, just like you're saying, and you're going to get into the benefits, anytime we're doing a test in general at all, we always just say, will this drastically change the outcome of what is happening? And so in these early times, will this absolutely change my level of cortisol and stress hormone and all of the things that I may be carrying with me? If that's the case, the benefit outweighs the risk. But like you said, having a Doppler and to check all the time, that's where you need radical acceptance. Of like, okay, you know there's a baby, you know there's a heartbeat. Beyond that, we have to have radical acceptance. We might not need to have radical acceptance in the first trimester if we've had this loss and we need a confirmation. And so this is the nuance of medicine. This is the nuance of these journeys, is it's not all or nothing. And it's not even the same thing for every woman. Because if you are this, you know, person who has no anxiety about fertility and you're going to be totally fine, it's the same thing of what we say, should we have a home birth or a hospital birth? And it's like, it literally depends on where you feel the most comfortable. that the answer, it changes based on the person in front of you. And this is something that people have such a hard time understanding, is that it is nuanced and it's based on the person in front of you and their situation. And that's just something we need to hold as we walk through this, and that there's no right or wrong co-sleeping versus, you know, sleep training, ultrasound versus no ultrasound. It's like there are nuances. And so anyone listening, I think that we do a great job of this, presenting the information, presenting both sides, and being like, it just depends. That's my favorite phrase.
It does. It just depends. And I want to bring up something too, which is that like the women who will go on to have no ultrasound and everything's fine, that experience confirms their bias about that was the right decision. It was fine. Everything was chill. See, like, you don't need to do it. Da da da. Then similarly, though, the women that will go on to have an ultrasound and they find some like huge issue that could have resulted in death of themselves or their baby or both will be like, yeah, I'm always doing ultrasound. Are you kidding? So we have to just remember in our like silly little human minds sometimes that our egos are really big. And what is right for us is not right for every single person. And so, and also we might make a mistake in choosing one way or another about something, you know, who knows? We're all just doing the best that we can and what feels right. So, okay, the other benefit of the first trimester ultrasound, in my opinion, is a dating ultrasound. So if you have no, like dating, like D-A-T-I-N-G, if you have no idea how pregnant you could be, say you have irregular cycles, PCOS, were breastfeeding, it's your first cycle back, any kind of a situation where you were not like accurately cycle tracking and you knew when you ovulated and then you happened to get pregnant on that cycle. If you do not have that clear, good data and information, I think that a like an early ultrasound, as soon as you realize that you are pregnant, because you could be whoever knows how pregnant, is a really good idea for a couple of reasons. If you're choosing a track where you are not going to have a medical professional attend your birth, you're doing a free birth, this doesn't matter because you're going to just have your baby whenever your baby's born. But if you're using a midwife in a home or birth center setting, you have to know that you will be risked out of that setting and sent to the hospital for induction at 42 weeks gestation. It is a law in almost all states.
Know all about it.
Yeah, you know all about it. It's not a law in every single state, but it is mostly all the way. For almost all states. And if you're planning a hospital birth, it's maybe not as big of a deal because you're like, well, I was in the hospital. You're sort of like willing to kind of go down the intervention route in a different sort of a way. Usually, sometimes, maybe not all the time, but like it really affects those that are planning out of hospital births. And so here's how it can change things. Let's pretend you're a woman who has a 35-day cycle. So if you have a 35-day cycle, we subtract 14-ish days of your luteal phase, maybe 13 days of your luteal phase. So now you're ovulating on day 22, right? Okay. That's really different than ovulating on day 14, which is all of the calculators that are going to be used. When you type in your last menstrual period date, your LMP, say you bled on day one of your cycle is the first day you bleed. Say your first day of bleeding was September 1st. The apps and calculators and algorithms that they use to calculate when your baby is due at 40 weeks are going to assume that you ovulated on day 14. Day 22 is really different from that. And it's a whole week, plus it's a week more. And what we know about our due date calculation is that most first-time women will deliver at 40 plus 5. There's averages where it's like 50% of women will have already delivered by like 40, I think it's 40 plus 5 and then 40 plus 3. But my point is that it's not at 40. Okay, we're late. We're going later. And first-time moms are notorious for going late. Really, it's just that you just stayed a little bit longer than what they say. But that's probably actually the more accurate due date. We just haven't adjusted our numbers. So do you see how if you have a due date that's saying your 40-week time is, let's just make up a number, March 15th, but actually it should have been March 23rd or something. Now you're up against this clock in even a different way, because you're probably going to go late anyway. You're probably going to deliver in that 41st week or close to it. And now we're stressed. And now we're stressed, which is not going to give us the oxytocin that we need to start labor. And we are up against a clock and our whole birth plan might change. So it's really, really important to know when your ovulation was. And if you have no idea, then getting an early ultrasound at like 6 to 9 weeks, somewhere in there, you have a bit of a window. They're pretty dang accurate because the fetal development of a human embryo and fetus is very like textbook for a certain period of time. And then we have more of those genetic changes, like, well, were the parents tall? Are they small? Like that kind of stuff comes in later. But in those early weeks, we can do a measurement and be like, this is a 6-week and 3-day fetus, you know? So we can get a more accurate due date that way. So if you do know, though, for some reason, you have a tracking app or you've been taking your temperatures and stuff, if you do know when you ovulated, this may be unnecessary. Also, though, when you're communicating your due date to your practitioner, use your ovulation date. Unless it's around day 14, then you can just use your LMP. But if they ask you for your LMP, you're someone with PCOS, but you are tracking and you saw when your ovulation was and it was on day 29, because sometimes it can be like that. That's really important. So you need to tell them that. And if your practitioner fights back on you about this and they're like, no, well, your LMP was this day. And you're like, yeah, but I know my ovulation was this day because my ovulation varies. And if they will not accept this, if they will not move forward with understanding this idea, get a different practitioner, because that's absolutely ridiculous. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's okay. I was just wondering, so in these situations, if a person has irregular cycles, PCOS or something, they don't know how long they've been pregnant, when they got pregnant, if you miss that 6 to 9 week window, because that's still pretty early, is it accurate after that? Or is it kind of like, now it's not really helpful? Like, because I don't know how many women would know to go in that early.
Yeah, no, it's still accurate. It's better than nothing, for sure. I'll tell you that. Like, even if we're getting into that, like, we think we're maybe 14 or 15 weeks pregnant, we're still, it's still giving us a pretty good idea where we had no idea beforehand. If I had my choice, though, it would be great if we could do it in that a little bit earlier phase, but it's still accurate. Even if we're 10, 11, 12 weeks, we need to get some sort of narrowed down idea of when this due date is, because we have no clue.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Okay. So hope that that makes sense about ovulation and why it affects your due date. And ovulation is variable. So that's another thing in the conventional world that sometimes they want to think ovulation is not variable. It's absolutely variable. You could take a medication, it could change your ovulation. You could get sick, it changes your ovulation. You have stress, you travel, you have a red eye flight. You have one red eye flight and your ovulation could be bumped back by several days. So that's why cycle tracking is really important. And fertility awareness method is great if we are actively participating in it because of those sorts of reasons. When people are like, oh, I tend to ovulate on day like 9 or 10. Okay, that's a cool average, but on any particular month,
like, when did you actually ovulate?
Yeah, when did you actually ovulate that month? Because if you're trying to prevent pregnancy, if you have sperm and vagina sex at any point, you could be messing this up and not knowing and then getting pregnant, you know, if you're trying to prevent. Now, same thing when you're trying to conceive. If we think that, oh, well, we had sex on day 9 because I ovulate on day 11 or something like that, and that was it, that's the only time you had sex, but that month you didn't actually ovulate until day 17, 19, you're going to miss it. Mm-hmm. So we need to know. We need to be intimately connected with our cycles. And it's actually fun. It's really fun. I do it with an Oura ring. You can do it with a thermometer, with a temp drop, with whatever. There's lots of different ways to do it. So, okay, let's talk about the other benefits of ultrasound, which to me is the anatomy scan. So the anatomy scan is something that you're going to get between like 18 and 21 weeks, usually somewhere in that window. It's the midway point, and it's where they're going to look at all of the major structures of the baby, the placenta, what's happening with your uterus, the position of the baby, the water. The position of the baby does not matter. Like, a lot of babies are breech at that point, but they're just going to look at it and see. Also, sometimes our women are diagnosed with twins at their anatomy scan because maybe they didn't do any other earlier ultrasounds, or during their early ultrasound, the tech saw one heartbeat focused on that spot and didn't like search the entire uterus. That happens all of the time. So at the anatomy scan, it's much harder to miss a second, you know, fully formed baby in there. But the benefits are to make sure that there's not big, huge issues that would affect the baby's life, your life, and your birth outcomes and your immediate postpartum outcomes. So let's talk about some of these things. So with the placenta, specifically to me personally, I pretty much only get my anatomy ultrasounds to check the positioning of the placenta. I do let them do, it's changed over time, but my most recent, my fourth anatomy scan was like 7 minutes long. It was so short. I was like, just overview. Okay, cool. Where's my placenta? Okay, get out of there. I think my first anatomy scan was like 45 minutes long with my son. So it was a lot longer. I would say that's pretty typical for it to land somewhere around between 30 and 45 minutes. But if you can find a cool tech who is compliant to your wishes, and you can just say, you know, I don't actually want or care about all of these measurements. Please do an overall scan. If there's something you see concerning, then you go a little deeper into that area. But like, I don't care about the circumference of the stomach if it looks overall okay to you here. Or, but like, you know, look at the heart, look at the brain, da da da, whatever. Okay. But so some of these things that can be found that would change things would be like a placenta previa. That is where the placenta is overlying the top of the cervical opening. And what can happen if it's a true, full, complete placenta previa that does not move is that when then now the mom is trying to go into labor and the cervix is trying to open up, there's hemorrhaging and bleeding until both parties die, basically, because there's no way for the baby to get out. And the placenta is so vascular and it's been implanted on a space now that's opening up like a radial dial. And so then there's blood, you know, terrible. But we have to know the statistics. So a true placenta previa, the percentage is really only 0.5% worldwide, 0.5. And in North America, it's actually 0.3%. So that's 3 births in 10,000. Okay, so, or sorry, 3 births in 1,000. A very low statistic. The other thing to know about placenta previa is that if they're diagnosed only in the second trimester, it has a very high false positive rate. So false positive, meaning that they're going to say, oh, you have this, sorry, this is going to be bad. But the thing is that up to 90% of placenta previas will move as the woman becomes more pregnant, because the uterus is stuck on the wall in like one position. And so as it's growing, like a hot air balloon is being blown up, that spot on the placenta is going to like shift up. It's not like the placenta is sliding around inside of the uterus. It's attached, but it's moving up the wall. And so it will likely move out of the way of the cervix, and then we're fine. So you need to, if you're getting this, just know, if they say on your anatomy scan that this is happening, this is a good reason to get rescanned later on in your third trimester to see, has it moved or not? And in that scan, it should be overall pretty quick. They're just going to check the position of the placenta in relation to the cervical os, which is like the opening. And that should be it. It's not going to be like a huge long thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that while 97% of women take a prenatal vitamin, over 95% are still deficient? That's why I love recommending Needed's Prenatal. Unlike most prenatals, Needed doses nutrients in the right forms and amounts that go above and beyond to really support both mama and baby. I actually worked with Needed for years. We spent over 3 years researching, working with practitioners, and really intentionally choosing every single nutrient form and dosage that's put into the prenatal. And now we have the data to back it up. In an IRB study, they found that the women who took the Needed Prenatal had higher blood levels of key nutrients like vitamin B6, vitamin D, vitamin B12, riboflavin, vitamin K2, and selenium, compared to women who are taking a regular prenatal. Even more powerful, only the Needed group had significant amounts of vitamin D in their system, which is essential for supporting the immune system, bone development, blood pressure regulation, and so much more. This study reinforces what we've known for a long time, that real nourishment really makes a difference, and the proper nutrients support fertility, pregnancy, and baby's health. Needed isn't just aiming for adequacy, they're supporting what's possible. No matter where you are along your fertility or pregnancy journey, Needed is what I recommend. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% on your first subscription order. Again, head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, now back to the show.
Okay, the next one would be a placenta accreta, which accreta means that it has burrowed into the musculature layer of the uterus, and it's not just superficially connected with vasculature. The placenta isn't. So it's like actually burrowed in, and it's not going to come out like in a normal way at all. These are much more higher risk if you've had a cesarean, because this is a situation where the placenta is attaching to the uterine wall where the previous scar was usually. And so there's a certain level of it that dysfunctionally sort of like embeds into the uterine wall because there's like this scarring there. So if you have had a cesarean, placenta accreta risk factor is somewhere between 1 in 600 and 1 in 270. So I know, it's kind of high. Now, if you've not had a cesarean, your risk of placenta accreta is 1.7 in 10,000. So it's very rare if you've not had a cesarean. Much more common if you have. Okay, so I guess I lay out these stats because it is, the odds are so much further in our favor. It's true. And I am the type of person that, although I love that mindset of just really wild, radical acceptance in pregnancy, if I was the person who had a full, complete previa and I didn't know it because I chose not to do an ultrasound, I personally could not live with that repercussion, that risk of my baby dying or maybe me dying too. To me, I think it's a silly thing to miss when it was an unnecessary death, you know, an unnecessary outcome where if I had known, I would have had a planned cesarean, gotten my baby out safely, moved on to live as a mother of now five or whatever it is, you know, like sometimes we need to zoom out the dial and be like, well, what's important here? And yeah, they're like 90% of them are going to change. And that's great. And that's in our favor evolutionarily for humans on this planet. Otherwise, we would not be able to be here if we had, you know, constant issues with the way our babies and our bodies were born. And we're different now. Like the anthropologist in me wants to say, it's all going to be fine. The human body is absolutely perfect and it's designed perfectly. And I do think that. And it's battling constant modern pressures that are not normal, not what we grew up with, not what we lived with. And now we have new things to contend with. And again, this is just where everyone has their own personal relationship with risk benefit. For me, I want to know where that freaking placenta is. Like, tell me.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the anatomy scan being about the placenta. That's such a good point. And I mean, there is a point to not to scare people, but I mean, there have been a lot of deaths of women throughout the years and in childbirth. I mean, it was a very common thing that would happen. And so people being like, oh, like, you know, we wouldn't be here. It's like, well, you're here because your maternal line survived, but a lot of them didn't. So there is always risk, even back in the day, even in animals. I mean, my family raises animals. It's like they also have issues. It's not like something in nature is ever without risk. So I think like modern tools, even I talk about this a lot, you know, my lens is always through fertility, but stuffing like IVF, that's a tool that's amazing, can be helpful for some people. Is it overused? Absolutely. Can it cause harm in the wrong context? Absolutely. It's the same thing with ultrasound. It's an amazing tool. Can it be overused? Absolutely. Can it be life-changing where it can give someone a baby where they wouldn't have it before, you know, like in the placenta previa kind of situation? Absolutely. And so you and I are both so balanced in that, I think, of how do we know the positives, the risks, the benefits, and move forward with that. And, you know, everyone can make their own decision based on what they're hearing on this episode. But I don't know. I feel like I'm biased in that. I feel like it's a healthy approach. Like you said, like there's very like the risk, I think, is so much lower than the potential benefit. And then if it's all good, great. Like, perfect. You get in, get out. Great.
Exactly. And, you know, everybody's just going to have to pick what feels the best for them. We don't have a crystal ball. My favorite thing to say. Yeah, I wish we did. And we don't. And so we just have to say, this was what feels the most right, given all the information I have. Plus my intuitive hits, which are important. We also kind of need to keep our, like, what we think is intuitive hits in balance too with, like, is that ego? What is it? What's going on? But, you know, like really looking at all the facts and the data. Okay, the last thing I'll say about placenta accreta is that the false positive, so on the event where an ultrasound tech says you have it, but you actually don't, is very, very low because it's a really clear, like, morphology that's very easy to see. Okay, so another thing that could be of a benefit with ultrasound is something like twin-to-twin transfusion, if you have twins. So, you know, twins are going to be monitored much more heavily. Sometimes twins are born in a free birth setting and everything is totally fine and dandy and hunky-dory and great. And that is so cool. And sometimes if there is issues with one twin not getting enough and it hasn't been managed in the way that it needs, that twin can die or have, you know, totally lifelong complications and issues where the other twin is getting like it's shunting all the blood flow to one twin, not the other. So that's another one, not very common, but still there. Something like a cord anomaly. So the cord and the placenta, again, are like really the reasons why I particularly do it. But so a cord anomaly that could really have a high risk if it's occurring is something called a vasoprevia. So vasoprevia is where the cord is in front of, or sorry, that the vasculature and the cord all like sort of runs in front of the cervix. And so if we are having a situation where baby's head would be like coming through and pushing through, there could be hemorrhage. There is a very, very high risk of this. It's 1 in 2,500 that this happens. And it's not that common. Now there's like velamentous cords where maybe there's like not enough Wharton's jelly on it. And those don't necessarily have like, you know, you have to have a planned cesarean or something, but there is a higher risk setting there that we want to be on the ready for in case there is increased bleeding. Now some rare things that are a huge deal to the baby after they're born would be things like congenital diaphragmatic hernia. So your diaphragm is like, you know, it splits your thoracic cavity from your abdominal cavity. It goes up and down when you breathe. It's the thing that creates the pressure that draws air into your lungs. And if there's a big hole in it, which is like a hernia, right? And all of the abdominal organs are coming up into the thoracic cavity where the heart and the lungs are, that's a really big, bad thing. And so a baby who has a congenital diaphragmatic hernia diagnosed on ultrasound will have like a rushed immediate surgery post-birth. They will be born into like a very high level hospital with a level 3 or 4 NICU, like, you know what I mean? Or not four, I don't know if it's 4, 3 or 4, like whatever. My point is like a high level NICU so that they can do those sorts of things. The false positives of that are very rare. So you're not going to be told you have that if you don't. They can miss it, but it's trickier to miss because it's a very obvious issue if the tech is trained. Another one would be like the congenital heart disease kids or kids that have any kind of, you know, heart thing that's going to necessitate, like my nephew was born with a great transposition of the vessels, but congenitally corrected. And so he didn't actually need surgery right after he was born, but he needed it at like 9 or 10 months. But still his immediate postpartum care as a baby, his immediate newborn care was really different because they wanted to get him stable, make sure everything was okay. It was like a little touch and go. So this stuff is important and you wouldn't know if you didn't have that. And it's like, how, again, for me, I would not be able to live with myself if a baby was born at home, because that's where I choose to birth, and then died shortly after because of something that I just did not know that was wrong with them, where I could have saved them. Some people have a different view on that. They're like, yeah, sometimes babies die. And sometimes like that was maybe the path of this baby. And they are really choosing to not engage in the medical system. That's not where I am, but I want to say that I can like understand where if that is your mindset, you go balls to the wall with that mindset, there can be really big tragic things that happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, another one is like, these are issues actually, problems with ultrasound, is that we find these little things like a choroid plexus cyst or an echogenic spot on the heart, like a focal point, a bright spot on the heart or a bright spot, a cyst in the brain. And these things really freak parents out. And it's so unfortunate because they have a very high false positive and they often, like almost all the time, go away, but they can be associated with the chromosomal issues like the trisomies. And so they're like soft markers, but apart from all the other information, this is where we need to look at the whole picture, because if that's all we're finding, everything is probably going to be okay. But sometimes they'll say that and they're like, oh yeah, your baby has a cyst on their brain. And it's like, what? You know, and often it resolves and it's not a big deal. Sometimes it does indicate it's a soft marker for something that was maybe bigger going on. So it's important to know that going into these ultrasounds that there is these problems, that they're not perfect again. Okay. And then the last one I want to say is like for IUGR, so intrauterine growth restriction, 5 to 10% of pregnancies will be, you know, experiencing this. This is more of a modern problem now, and it's like higher and lower socioeconomic regions, and maybe has to do with nutrition. We don't really know. Well, we know some things, but it's also increasing rapidly too. So it's a problem we need to figure out, but it increases your stillbirth risk by 5 to 10%.
Wow.
That's really high. That's really high. So there is an up to 30% positive false positive rate on those. So it's tricky because the solution is to birth the baby earlier than like just waiting for spontaneous labor. And so sometimes they're getting induced at like 35, 36 weeks. Sometimes it's more just like 38, 39. But if we really truly have that situation, it is best for the baby to be born. And I think that that's, it's like, yeah, you do it. And then you nurse your baby. Yeah, did you get to have the spontaneous labor and the birth you probably wanted? Maybe not. And that sucks, but like this baby needs to come out, you know? So those are some of the things to me that I'm like, why not get this information? Even with the false positive and false negative rates, like it's okay. We can look at it all together.
Yeah.
So to end, the balance, I think, is that we can look at this like from a 10,000 foot view and say, there are some benefits. There are some risks. Most of the risks are theoretical or in a like false positive, false negative kind of thing where we like think everything's fine, but actually something's going on. Or we're told that everything is doom and gloom, but everything is fine. And those are hard situations when you're butted up against those realities. And, you know, sometimes more information isn't better. And, you know, that's going to be just like, you'll have to just go down that path. It's one of the risks you take when opening up the Pandora's box of testing. Like you mentioned in the very beginning, like sometimes people just want to go get big functional tests. They're like, let's just go see what's happening. And then they find these like incidental things that aren't actually really clinically relevant for what's happening in the case. But it's like, whoa, what do we do with that now? And it does make things complicated and complex. But so it seems as though we can have a good relationship with ultrasound where we limit them to medically indicated reasons only. We reduce our keepsake sort of like for the pictures, just for fun, for the hell of it, because we want to see our baby, uses of Doppler and, you know, ultrasound photography. If during your anatomy scan, you want to snap a photo or something, I mean, I've done that. I think that's fine. It's like, whatever. Maybe some people are like, oh my God, I would never. And I'm like, okay, cool. You do it. I think the risk of that is probably so low that I do it. Okay. That surprises people all the time. I have a little photo of every single one of my babies in that kind of like crazy copper colored background where they look like an alien. And mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
We have to remember too, that the ACOG and WHO are sort of like not up and coming in a lot of areas of maternal care or not all that great in certain ways. They also say this, that we should only be getting ultrasounds in medically indicated ways and we should keep them as short as possible just to get the diagnostic information we need and then we get out. So we want to avoid them as much as we can, use them in smart ways where we can be kind of finding that Goldilocks spot between risk and benefit. We do need way more recent, like modern, long-term and high-quality studies for sure. Like it's a work in progress, you guys, but we're trying. All right. Like it's 2025. We're trying. The first trimester scans and early Doppler use are the ones that are associated with the higher of the like risk. But again, it's very low when you look at this, the numbers overall. And I think that there's a way where we can do this that appeases sort of like safety and quelling anxiety or getting a good dating ultrasound, because those things matter. Like we want to do it when it's going to matter. Like you had said, quelling anxiety, I think matters. And I also really think that getting an accurate due date matters. So if we need to do that for the first trimester, we do that. But if you only want to get one ultrasound in your pregnancy and you want to get the anatomy scan, that would probably be if I had the ideal wand to wave on every woman, I would say just get the anatomy scan and make it brief, but get the information you need. Just don't have the tech be hanging out and talking to you and chatting and you're just like dilly-dallying and the wand's on your belly. Like, no, tell them, I want you to do this as fast as you can with getting the information, da-da-da-da-da, whatever. And then if we need to dip into more ultrasounds because something's going on, then we do, because that's how we maintain and manage what's happening, you know? Now, I know some people will say, gosh, but you open up this box of this can of worms where it's like, now you're allowing them to say that you need all these extra ultrasounds. And just know, you can always deny it, but when there's monitoring needed, it's okay. Now, one thing I didn't talk about is the biophysical profile at the very end of pregnancy. That's like where you're in your 40th week, 41st week, and they want to check on the baby's blood flow, their like response to any contractions you're having, and then your amniotic fluid levels. And that's another one where I don't know. I feel like overall biophysical profiles are kind of if we're going to be talking about like opening up a can of worms where maybe there's incidental things found that aren't actually all that applicable, that's sort of where I see that happening the most. Or they take a measurement of the baby and they're like, holy shit, this baby's 11 pounds. And the baby comes out at like 8 pounds, you know? So there is more issues that can come from that, depending on what kind of information you're trying to get. Just know that like, so much of the world doesn't do any of that kind of thing. They are checking your heart, the baby's heartbeat. Like through your prenatal appointments, you're going to have a Doppler. And I think that's fine. Like your midwife comes over to your house, they listen to your baby's heartbeat. Maybe they use a fetoscope, which is hard to do, but they can do that, which is basically a stethoscope, but it's this very long, skinny horn thing. And, you know, midwives use them for sure. OBGYNs do not use a fetoscope. And I think that that, you know, finding the baby's heartbeat and making sure that it sounds good, it's high enough, like all that kind of thing is great. Because again, that's like normal monitoring, but I just don't think we should own them in our homes and be using it willy-nilly. Okay, so that's all I have to say.
This is so great.
It's a lot.
That's all you have to say. I feel like that's an entire course on ultrasounds. So you can check that off your continuing education. No, I'm just kidding. This was great. You're such a wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. And I hope that everyone listening feels empowered and they have all the information. I learned a lot, you know, even though I'm a doctor, I've been through 2 births. I'm still like, oh my God, what? That's so crazy. So thank you, Dr. Morgan.
Thank you. Are you pregnant or you're trying to conceive and you're looking for reliable natural health information about how to have a healthy pregnancy and also prepare for the future steps in motherhood to come, like the birth, the breastfeeding, and the postpartum? Because I have got you. So this is exactly the reason why I made the 6-week pregnancy call. And it's my most comprehensive resource. It's the thing that I absolutely love. I've poured my heart and soul into it. It's all of the things that I wish that every woman knew when they are entering motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 class, and a postpartum planning course all in one. And normally I run it as a class with live Q&A calls, but now it's available in a content-only format so that you can purchase it at any time and start learning immediately. It's called the lessons-only format, and it is just only all of the video lessons that you'll get access to for forever. So log on to milkmedicine.com/lessons-only or check out the link in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.